Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Tuesday, March 19th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, I'm going to present a couple of interviews centered on the film Bob Marley, One Love. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and it is just me today, at least in this little intro. I recently had the chance to speak with writer-director Reynaldo Marcus Green and star Kingsley Benadire about Bob Marley, One Love, a film that, I'm going to be completely honest here, I did not outright love. I thought that there were some good things about it. The music was obviously terrific. I largely dug the look of the movie, and Kingsley Benadire's performance is the best thing about the whole thing. But I personally felt like it didn't really tell me as much about Bob Marley as I would have liked to know. Lashana Lynch plays Bob's wife, Rita, in the movie, and while she has one big standout scene where she has this argument with Bob in the streets of Paris, she otherwise doesn't really feel like a super fleshed out character to me. I think because Ziggy Marley, Bob's son, was the main producer on this film, I got the sense that the film kind of sidestepped some of the more unsavory aspects of Bob's life, which is a problem not just with this movie, to be fair, but with this whole new era of biopics and documentaries where the subjects or members of their estate have so much control over the narrative being told. There's a trade-off there, right? Like, because if you didn't have the Marley family's approval, you wouldn't be able to use the songs in this movie. And obviously the music is what people are paying for when they go to a film like this. So I understand that it's a tricky balance that directors can find themselves in sometimes. This movie has made nearly $170 million worldwide. And this is one of those films that has a huge gap between critics' reactions and general audience reactions. I really don't like Rotten Tomatoes as a metric, but the fastest way to underscore this point that I'm trying to make is just to relay the fact that the film currently has a 43% from critics and a 92% audience score. So chances are if you saw this movie and you're listening to this, you liked the movie more than I did. But even if you didn't, I still think these interviews are worth checking out. Oh, and by the way, as of today, the movie is available to buy or rent on digital, and then it comes to 4K, Blu-ray, and DVD on May 28th. So first up, Reynaldo Marcus Green. Until now, he was probably most famous for directing 2021's King Richard, the film that won Will Smith an Oscar for playing Richard Williams, the father of tennis legends Venus and Serena. He directed another impressive lead performance here in this movie and brought some nice visual touches to this story in the form of the visions that Bob has throughout the film. I really enjoyed this conversation with him, and I would keep an ear out for the bit where he talks about collaborating with his cinematographer and how that relationship helped set the tone for the entire set. That was my favorite part of this conversation. So here is my chat with Reynaldo Marcus Green. Hey, Reynaldo, how are you?
Good. How you doing?
I'm excellent. Thank you so much for taking the time today. I appreciate it. So I want to ask you about, like, in the earliest days of this project, what kinds of conversations were you having with the studio about your vision for this movie?
With the studio, I think it was script related. I had received the draft that they had commissioned from Terrence Winter and Frankie Flowers. So that was my first interaction with the project, was the script. And I said, look, there's a lot of really good things in the script. But, you know, there are some, I think there's some room for improvement. And I need to go on this journey of discovering what this movie is. There's a lot of movie here, and it needs some, it just needs a bit more focus and shape. And so part of that journey for me was bringing on my co-writer and Zach Balin, who had written King Richard. And fortunately for me, Zach grew up in Wilmington, Delaware, just up the street from where Bob lived when he was in Delaware. And Bob and Zach had dreads in high school and was this huge Zach Marley fan. Zach Marley fan. He was a huge Bob Marley fan. So it just was like serendipity. The guy that wrote King Richard was a, you know, had dreads and worshiped Bob Marley and lived up the street from him. So it just you know, it's like the universe was saying, okay, something has to happen here.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was, look, I had such a great relationship working with him on King Richard, and to be able to bring him onto this and help crack the structure of the film. That was our work. And that was the conversation. Those were my early conversations with the studio, was making sure that I had the right combination to take the script to the next level. There was so much good in there, and but we knew it needed shape. And you know, that was the first part of the journey.
I spoke with Kingsley earlier, and he mentioned that authenticity was like the big sort of key word, basically. And I'd like to talk with you about that idea for a second, because almost all of your feature films have been based on true stories. So I'm curious for you if you've ever actually felt creatively boxed in by the truth when you're making movies like that. Do you ever look at that as a downside, I guess, in some way?
I mean, I think earlier on, I held on to the truth a lot more, just because that's what you do in film school. You know, this happened this way, it has to be, right? I remember going into prep on King Richard, and we went to the actual Williams family house, like in Compton. And I was like, we have to shoot here. And my production designer was like, no, you don't. He was like, you don't want to shoot here, and here's why. You know, and just being able to open up as a filmmaker and opening up that vision of, look, we're telling stories, okay? Every film is a fictionalized version of the truth, and that's just the reality of it, that you can take certain liberties and still be truthful in those liberties. And I think I learned a lot in the process of Joe Bell to King Richard, you know, to We Own the City, to now Bob Marley, that I knew I can take a lot more liberties and still be telling a version of the truth. Because what is the truth? There's been over 500 books written about Bob Marley. Whose truth is it? And I think ultimately you're looking for common denominators. You're looking for things that a lot of people are saying. Of course, there's the news. There are certain facts, and but it's also like a journalist who wrote it. Like there's always another layer. You know, what's that game in school where you play? I think it's telephone, right? You start here, and then by the end, it's a completely another story. And like that's a little bit the space that we're playing in. And I think for Bob, the good news is that there was enough information about there about his life that we couldn't veer so far. But then there were blank canvas, and that's fun. That's exciting. You know, yes, there were stories about how Exodus was made. It was a story. How do we cinematically depict that story? There were stories about Bob, you know, singing songs around the campfire. Great. It was a story. How do we cinematically depict that in our film? There were stories about Bob having known who the shooter was. Did he forgive them in the, like, how he forgave them is up to us. We can take those liberties. There were visions. Bob had visions. How do you depict a vision in the movie? And so for me, that was the fun part, was being able to kind of fill in the blanks. And if it were all just facts and you know, it would probably be a little less fun. You know, my wouldn't be as important. And it was the same in King Richard. I think I realized then that you can open a movie up in a way that maybe if it were just the truth, it wouldn't be exciting. You know, Venus didn't play in front of in an open air arena in front of thousands of fans, but that's a lot more exciting than a closed arena with 200 people and some parents. So is it any less truthful? I don't know. It just seems great. And I think
it.
it allows us to have an emotion, and that must, and honestly, part of me was like, that must have been how she felt. She must have felt like she was playing to thousands of people. And that's enough of the truth to me to warrant putting it in that space. And the same thing for Bob. You know, on the Exodus tour, you know, what was the max amount of people that he played to? You know, maybe it wasn't 80,000 as he got to later on in life in Italy. But is that important? What's important is that you see a growing crowd, that you saw his stardom was rising, that you saw him becoming a global superstar. And so visually, it's my job to help that happen. Obviously, I agree with Kingsley when it comes to the authenticity and getting that right. But authenticity is in our film, language and emotion. And if you feel anything when you leave the film, then we truthfully gave you that feeling.
So you're talking about those visions, and I want to talk about your collaboration with Robert Elswit for a second. I mean, this guy is like a pretty legendary cinematographer at this point, and I think you guys have worked together before, right?
Yeah, now it's my third time. We did King Richard. That was our first film together. And then we did a doc series on Netflix called Mend. And bringing him back for Bob was paramount, no pun intended, for me, because he just, First of all, he's one of my best friends. I love Robert. He lives up, I literally moved to his town just because he lives up the street, and it was our way to hang out and watch movies together. And you know, we're sort of unlikely odd couple, but it's great and it works for us. And he's just the best, and he loves movies. He's a filmmaker. You know, we don't talk camera, we don't talk lenses. It's the thing that comes last. It's always story. What are we trying to tell? Where are we trying to go? I just love being with him because he's a storyteller, and he's able to help me articulate my vision. He's never tried to get in the way of that. He's always tried to support that. That's the mark of a great DP. If you ask him, I think he's one of the greatest to ever do it. You know, and he's just working. You know, like, it's amazing. He just has a work ethic, which is incredible. Every morning he's up before I am, and he's going back to location, you know, six, seven, eight times. You know, before sunset, after sunset, during sunset. Like, how many times you have to see it, Robert? We got to go again. That's just who he is. And it's you know, it shows you the old school way of working. I think we lost a lot of that. I think we lost a lot of touch. And I love kind of learning on the old school kind of way, because I think there's a lot to be learned from my time with Robert. I hope we get to make a few more together.
So, having known him for this long, have you been able to basically pump him for stories about all the things that he's worked on? Have you like satisfied your curiosity of all the behind the scenes stuff or all these legendary things that he's done?
You know, it's interesting. Robert is—he's one of the most loyal people I've come to know, and he's worked with the same guys, same gaffers, same grips. Now, of course, there's a rotation of them because they work on Tarantino or they work on PTA, and so there's a few guys he uses, but he always uses the same. And when I say guys, guys and girls, he uses the same team, and it's like ride or die. It's amazing to watch. So when I get Robert, I don't just get Robert. I get Eric Brown. I get Chris Centrella. I get Ian. I get these guys. I get a team of Elswood, and the loyalty and how they protect each other. So it's like a quarterback getting an offensive line. Like, if I have two tackles that are gonna block, like, I could throw to anybody. I've got like forever to connect passes. And that's what it feels like. I'm getting 30 plus years of experience on every down. That's a it's like a it's a it's night and day when it comes to that, because there's no panic. There's nothing they haven't seen or done. There's no so you can relax. You can relax when there's no panic around you. And then your actors can relax when they're not focused on hitting marks every down. Go and run a route. Feel free to go off script. Feel free to play. And that it gives the set a culture. I'm the new blood, and then they're the old blood. And how do those two, it's a great marriage, because I can bring a certain energy that maybe they can't. And my vision is what guides the process. So they could be my eyes where I have blinders. And I can be there. I could be the sort of field of view, I guess, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's awesome. I've never heard it put that way before, but that sounds great. So you guys obviously had a strong visual approach for what you wanted to do here. Tell me about your sonic approach. How did you want to handle the music scenes in this movie?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the short answer is I wanted to feel like I got a VIP ticket to a Bob Marley show. And that show was, how did he write music? Where did he write music? What was it like as he was writing music? How did he rehearse? How did he perform? How did he record? And I wanted to know what it was like being a fly on the wall in all those scenarios. And that to me was really interesting, because those were my favorite parts of some of the movies that I had seen, whether it was Love and Mercy and how they were, you know, I just love that stuff. That's like, it's gold. And how do you go in those spaces and like, what could it have been like being there and watching him? And so that was part of the sort of construction of those scenes, was like, what was it like when he was in his bedroom? Like, it wasn't a record. It wasn't, he didn't know all the words. He was still working them out. And so we could approach the scene organically that way. You know, like, yes, here are the lyrics of the song that you're singing, but like, maybe he didn't figure it out just yet. So that it doesn't sound like, oh, we're listening to a recorded Bob Marley track in his bedroom. False. You're out of the movie. You're taken out. So I think the approach was, which space are we in? How do we recreate that? Now the recorded tracks were a little easier, right? We had the recordings. All we had to do was try to match it as much as we could. We were fortunate that we hired real musicians to surround Kingsley with. So you have the real Family Man son playing, you have the real Junior Marvin son playing their own parts. So not only real musicians, but real offspring of the musicians. You know, all of the i3s, singers. Lashana Lynch was a singer before she was an actress. You have real musicians, Carly, played by Hector Roots, real drummer, fantastic musician. So we could put Kingsley in a simulated, essentially, situation, and he was the only one that didn't play. So it was kind of amazing, but I think it gave him that confidence. It surrounded him with that authenticity that he was looking for, right? You give someone a dance partner, they can start dancing. But if two people don't know how to dance, then we got a problem.
Maybe I'm wrong about this, so please correct me if I am, but it kind of seemed like in some shots, whatever instrument was closest to the camera was like bumped up a little bit louder in the mix to emphasize that instrument. Is that true? Is that a real thing that you guys did on the technical end of it?
I would say, I mean, I don't remember all the ins and outs, but I would say that's probably right. If you're centered or you're feeling like, you know, what you're looking at is what you should be hearing in theory a little bit more, your eyes gravitate towards that thing. And I think the instrumentation specifically is really important to hear because I think that's the genius of the music, whether he used horns or strings and what was that instrumentation. So yeah, I think in the mix, we certainly try to accentuate what was there so that you can hear. And that people, I've heard a few people say, oh, I never remember the horns on that song before. I didn't know that there was a harp or whatever, you know, whatever we were using. It was great to kind of pull that out. You know, a lot of the original recordings were in stereo mix. And so we were able to re-record a lot of the and isolate instruments and then pull them out in a way that you could not do in sort of the, you know, original masters. And so we can manipulate the masters with some overlaying of real instrumentation and re-records, which just helped to bring the music to the forefront. It's like, yeah, it's like when I put on my Apple Vision Pro, you know, you're like, oh, well, this is different.
For
You know,
sure.
you're in it.
So you directed every episode of We Own the City, which you mentioned earlier, and that show came out in 2022. I'm guessing that was before you were filming this. I was just curious if there was anything that you learned from that project specifically that you were able to then take into the making of Bob Marley One Love.
Yeah, I mean, you learn something from all those projects. I mean, I had really amazing producers and showrunners on We Own the City. David Simon, George Pelicanos, and Nina Noble are like, I mean, like that level of clarity of vision. Scripts were airtight. They ran a ship. But what I loved about them was that they keep going back to Baltimore, and they're not like, hey, I just come to Baltimore and make shows and leave. They're part of Baltimore. They make Baltimore part of their production. And so I think when you're shooting in a foreign country like Jamaica, how do you not go in there and be just like an outsider? How do you make your production part of the community in which you're shooting? And for me, it was important to do that. And I remember Nina Noble. She was giving back to the community as we were shooting there. So it wasn't just like we were just taking from Baltimore. We were giving to Baltimore and making sure that we put roots in Baltimore. And so for me, I remember early on, I was like, look, we're shooting in the streets of Trenchtown. Like, we got to do something here. So we did. You know, I asked Paramount and my producers to work on something that we can do for the community. And we left the school. We left a wing of a school, and we were able to not just shoot a movie in Jamaica, We were able to leave something behind. And with the help of Paramount and the Marley family, we were able to leave not only a movie, which will probably be the biggest thing that's ever come out of Jamaica, but hopefully an opportunity for the next generation to have a place to go and become the next Bob Marley or the next Rita Marley or the next I3. And that's the real work. The real work is becoming part of the communities in which you're depicting. You know, am I Jamaican? No, but I feel like I can go to Jamaica and be proud of what we did there. And that, yeah, that they gave us as much as we gave them. It was a two-way street all the way through. We couldn't have done it without their support. I don't know. It just it that that's what I learned about working with those guys, just how important community is. And working with non-actors and actors, that combination is what we did almost to a T in Bob Marley. We have a mix of both, and it really adds that layer of authenticity that you feel like you're on the streets of Trenchtown, that you feel like you're with the real Rastas because you are. Those are real Rastas. I can't play a Naya Bingi drum. You can't teach that. You can't grow that type of hit. It's, you know, the guy who plays Mortimer Plana, Ricky, in our film, his hair touches the actual floor. That's 40 plus years of growth. It's like, it's funny. I said to him, I said, you know, because he had it tied up. And then when he brought it down, I said, oh my God, I didn't realize how long it was because it actually sits on the top of his head. And he took it down. He said, are you sure you want me to take it down? It's really powerful. I didn't understand what he's talking about, but it was like tree roots and the spirituality and the spiritual nature of it. It's not a cool hairstyle. You know, it's a way of life. And that approach only helped to deepen our filmmaking, you know, and try to make something as authentic as we were getting from the folks of Jamaica.
Excellent. Well, I think I'm out of time with you, but congrats on the movie and thank you again so much for the time.
My pleasure, man. Thank you.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Kingsley Benadire is an actor who has played iconic real-life figures on screen already, including Malcolm X and Barack Obama. He was somewhat reluctant to take on the role of Bob Marley because he didn't know how to sing or play the guitar, which seems like a pretty crucial aspect to this character. But ultimately, he learned how to do both for this movie. I read that the singing in the film is a mixture of Kingsley's voice and the real Bob. As you will hear in this discussion, he's a guy who chooses his words carefully and clearly thought a lot about how to make this portrayal as authentic as possible. As I mentioned, Bob Marley One Love performed very well at the box office, but he also played a supporting role as one of the Kens in last year's mega hit Barbie. And when I spoke to him last week, his appearance at the Oscars, 2 Sundays ago, was still very fresh on my mind. So our conversation began with a little detour into that before getting into the main event. So here is my conversation with Kingsley Benadire. Hi, Kingsley. How are you?
And how you doing?
I'm great. Congrats on the movie. So I wanted to start by saying that it's only been a few days since the Oscar ceremony where you were a part of that incredible I'm Just Ken number. And I was curious, I mean, that was like the highlight of the night. And I was wondering from your perspective, what was that whole Oscars experience like for you on Sunday and in the days leading up to it?
It was such a wonderful way to experience the Academy Awards for the first time. And knowing that we were going to be doing this performance, you know, well, I came on Friday and rehearsed maybe for an hour or two over the over those couple of days. We were getting notes on the dance during the show. You know, it was our inclusion was very, very last minute, and it was Ryan who reached out and asked us to come and do it, and we all were like, "Yeah, we'll be there. Don't you worry." I haven't been on stage in a long time. I think the last time I was on stage was 2015. And I remember being backstage with Shooty just before we were going on. And I was like, what are we doing? Why are we here? Like, why have we done this to ourselves? The fear kicks in. And you try and breathe through it and remember that, you know, you're in an ensemble and everyone's going through it, and you breathe. And as soon as we walked out, it just went away. It was just such a loss. And I'm really fun. And it was okay that I felt like my Ken at least had permissions not to know all the moves off by heart, because I didn't. You know, I was looking to my left, looking to my right, seeing what everyone else was doing. I was behind. But what a buzz. And it was lovely to inject a little bit of silliness and a little bit of joy into the evening, to be a part of it. You know, it was great.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So let's shift gears to Bob Marley, One Love. And during your research period, as you were trying to really find your way into the character of Bob Marley, I was wondering if there was anything that you discovered that you either went to Ronaldo or the writers and said, like, hey, I think we should really include this in the movie.
Oh, yes. A lot.
What was that? Do you have an example of one that you can think of?
Loads, yeah. Yeah. To think of one. Whoa. Our first day was really the natural mystic scene, the creation of natural mystic. And I remember, you know, watching the redrafting of loads of scenes kind of change over the months. And there was something about those two moments where Bob was in the studio where I felt like I definitely needed to improvise a little bit, because it was the first couple of days. And it's just a wonderful moment in this interview that I kind of fell in love with, where Bob talks about suffering, you know, now we don't want our children to suffer. When I remember going on a rant, you know, kind of monologuing for probably a bit too long. But there were lots of insert. There were lots of pieces from that monologue that ended up in the final cut.
Oh, that's great.
A lot of Bob's language from interviews that I studied are like scattered all over the film. So the 9 months of listening to him leading up to day one of shooting was, I mean, it was essential.
Yeah. Yeah, that's wild. Yeah. So you mentioned the sort of scenes, like there are several scenes in this movie where the film really takes pleasure in the songs as they are being performed, either in the studio or on the stage. And I know that you learned to sing and play guitar for this film. Once you got over what I assume must have been a sort of nervous feeling to really sit in those music scenes and kind of revel in them the way that the movie does, did you find an approach that worked for you in terms of like how to actually go about performing the music in this film take after take? Did you have like a way in that you figured out eventually?
I mean, honestly, it's just repetition. It's just rinse, repeat, repetition, check in, tweak, rinse, repeat, rinse, repeat. It's just you over it and over it and over it and over it and over it. It's like Tony Hopkins. I remember when I was at drama school, I think it was Tony Hopkins said, you know, you got to run your lines 250 times if you have to, so that you're not thinking about it. Al Pacino came in to talk to us when I was at drama school as well, and he said, know your lines like the back of your hand. Like, you know, you have to know what you're doing. You prep. It's all prep. You prep to death, and then you come in. You hope it's kind of in you, because you need to let go and not be thinking about prep. So it's really not that interesting, really. It's really just repetition. It's times table work. It's like football drills, you know. It's like you just, that's what you have to do once you've done the emotional groundwork. So like with any character, you're trying to find the internal kind of moral and ethical dilemma that they're going through at the time and trying to connect that to the external. Mm-hmm. Everything is always the same. Once you understand that, then it's just prep. It's just like going over the scenes, knowing where you are in the film, what it is you want to capture, and yeah.
So one of the things that this movie makes clear is that for Bob, there wasn't really a persona that he had like off stage and a persona that he had on stage. The music and the messages that he was trying to put into the world were intertwined in a way that feels unlike a typical musician. And I was wondering if that element of the story informed your performance at all. Were you able to sort of draw a line between the onstage Bob and the offstage Bob and sort of keep that connected all throughout your performance? Did you think about it in those terms at all?
Yeah, Bob had definitely had a public persona. You know, the public and the personal are always two different things. The way I'm talking to you now, I'm trying to make it feel like this is how I would talk to my friends. But my mind, there are certain things that I know I can't say. There's certain language that I know I can't use. And we're having a kind of controlled conversation where there's a certain image of me that I need to get across because I'm supporting the movie. It's not about me. It's about positive, you know. So listening to Bob in interviews and then finding out through his friends what he was like out of those interviews and trying to figure out what those things were. I think for we, the music and the message are the same thing. That line came at the end of the improvisation that I was telling you about. Like, the message in Bob's music is very, very complex. It's Bob is talking about God in all of his music, and the Bible and his belief system, spiritual and emotional, around Haile Selassie being God. So for me, that line was so important because when he's auditioning Junior Marvin to come and join him as a British Jamaican who isn't currently a Rasta man, what he's saying to him is, our music is about Rasta. Rasta is about God, and God is our message. And that's what we're trying to communicate. Mm-hmm. One love is a metaphor that we can all interpret in our own ways. And the theme of love in this movie is more than just the theme of we all have to get together and be all right together. We all have to get together in ourselves. Bob talks about being still and listening. So what inner peace meant to Bob is going to mean inner peace is different to you as it is to me. So it's a much larger conversation talking about Bob's message for me. Because he was a religious man and believed in God. And that's what his music is. That's what's in the music. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. There's something about Bob that it kind of seems like sometimes he could go into like a fugue state or something. Like he was transported to another plane while he was performing. Mm-hmm. And I think anybody who does anything creative can relate to the feeling of, you know, the painting or the music or the acting or whatever the art is kind of taking over. And I was wondering for you if there was a moment that you had when making this movie where you felt that as an actor.
Well, you're always trying to drop in. You're always trying to fly off the cliff. You should always feel, I always think that like when you hear action, you're trying to get into a place where you feel like you're falling really, really from a high place. And then you, just as you're about to smash your face on the floor, you take off and you have no sense of time or what's good. It's about presence in the moment. You don't always achieve it. Because it depends who you're playing opposite, depends what take you're on, depends what's going on that day. But those scenes are always the scenes that are best because you can watch them and go, I didn't know, you know, you want to get to the end of a take and go, like, I don't really know like how that went because I was present, you know. Mm-hmm. But
do you remember a moment like that on this movie? Did you have that experience at all?
Yeah, lots. Yeah. Okay. Lots of moments. Yeah. Lots of moments. And then some scenes were more technical. We had to kind of like hit stuff, but you know, that doesn't necessarily mean like out of control in a frenzy where you're like, it just means that you were like, you know, in your groove or in the moment. You know, some scenes require like, what some scenes require is actually simplicity and like just, but yeah, on stage, yeah. On stage, you know, we found a few of those moments, I hope, and not all of them made the cut, but yeah.
I was wondering about that. Was there anything that you personally wanted to see in the film that didn't make the cut, whether it was cut for time or any other reason?
Yeah, loads of stuff. I lost a bunch of songs. I lost a bunch of songs. The movie didn't need all of the music that I prepared. But I think it's just selfishly, you know, I think of the months that went into to get them, you know, they were like hours and hours of me and Polly trying to work out how we were going to do certain things on certain concert scenes that didn't make it in the cut. But it was all part of the process of helping the family in the studio and Ray to have more material than they needed so that they could refine the film to find the movie of One Love that they all wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a monologue in the studio that I would have loved to have seen.
Maybe we can hold out hope that it'll show up in a deleted scene somewhere. Yeah, or something
might,
like that.
But... might come.
So I only have a couple more minutes with you, but I watched an interview with you where you said that when you were listening to those tapes of Bob when you're preparing, you originally only understood about like 70% of what he was saying because the accent and the voice was so strong. And I think you captured it really well in the final movie. I was wondering if anybody, like an executive or something, ever came up and said, hey, can you like lighten up on that accent a little bit? Like, even though, you know, it was you were running toward the idea of capturing the spirit of Bob.
No.
Oh, good.
I don't think anyone would have had the courage to ask me to do that if they had. And I don't think anyone in the studio ever wanted that.
Okay, good.
Studio, the first meeting I had was with Ziggy and Brian and Mike and everyone was on the same page. The authenticity was the most important thing.
So, that's got to be a great feeling for you, knowing that.
I'm very scary for them.
Yeah.
But it was the only way, you know. There's no version of this with Ziggy and the family where that was going to be kind of compromised. You know, it was just about me trying to get as far as I could get in the time that I had. There were a couple of scenes where like Ziggy and I spoke about, or Ziggy kind of went, this is a complex version of the patois. Bob would also say it in this way that isn't as complex a patois, but Bob would say it like that. So let's help the audience and choose this version. But in the instances where this is just how Bob's going to say it, they may or may not understand. That's what we did. You know, like where Bob would use a word that actually is a different language. We had conversations about that, how like, what's best for the movie here? Do we use this word that is a different language, or do we use the English word that Bob would also use? And so we just kept having those conversations, you know. Yeah, the Pitney Dem was something that we spoke about a lot. And we kept some use. We've got Bob using that and Bob saying kids. No, Bob wouldn't say kids. I think that was the conversation. He'd never say kids. The Pitney Dem or the children, you know, or children, you know. So like that, we spoke about stuff like that.
Yeah, that's great. Well, the work is tremendous. You did such an amazing job in it. And congratulations on the movie. And thanks for the time today. I appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you, man.
Thanks to the folks at Paramount for facilitating these interviews. And thanks to Ronaldo and Kingsley for all of their thoughtful answers. You can find more about Bob Marley One Love at slashfilm.com. I will try to link to a couple things in the show notes as well. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Please send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Don't be afraid to send an email. I will definitely read all of them, if not fully on the show. Please leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. It helps get in front of new listeners, which is always great. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.